Oh, thank you, John. Morning, everyone. Morning. Now, I see from the clock that I don't have to rush today. I've got plenty of time. Got a good hour and a half. Not really, of course. But if you've been coming regularly, you'll probably know already that we've been going through a series looking at the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, and the long list of people who are listed there for us as examples of exemplary faith, great heroes of the faith. But by verse 32, which is where we've kind of reached today, the writer, not having time to give more examples, give more details, they simply list further examples, further people. And within that group, we come across Samson. Now, Samson is well known in British society. And that's probably due, I think, anyway, to childhood storybooks, because like Noah and the Ark, Daniel in the Lion's Den, Samson and Delilah, these are popular stories. They're still fairly popular. And I also remember when I was growing up, Samson and Delilah in films. You know, there was a season when Bible stories were in vogue. You know, Ben-Hur, the Ten Commandments. I can remember living in Edinburgh and queuing up outside the cinema to see the Ten Commandments. And the queue went down the street. People were caught up in a season of epic Bible stories. Yet, as we'll see, Samson appears to be one of the most unlikely candidates you could ever come across as an example of faith. You know, these people listed are meant to be examples to us, to encourage us to be people of faith. But Samson is anything but. You know, he's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy. So it's fitting then that on Mothering Sunday, our tale about Samson begins with an angelic visitation to Samson's mother. We're going to go to Judges in chapter 13. And once again, we'll see that this familiar pattern, God's people turning away from God and going their own way, and then God raising up a judge. So let's look at verse 1 to 10. And I do apologize that I haven't had time this week to put the overhead together. You'll have to trust me on the Bible. I'm using my NIV. Yours might read a little different because one of the things they tend to do is update the NIV from time to time, and it doesn't quite read the same as the one I've got. But this is the one I was given when I first became a Christian. It's still intact, and it's the one I like to use because I'm familiar with it. So Judges 13, 1 to 10. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. A certain man of Zorah, named Manoah, from the clan of the Danites, had a wife who was sterile and remained childless. The angel of the Lord appeared to her and said, "You are sterile and childless, but you're going to conceive and have a son. Now see to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink, and that you do not eat anything unclean, because you will conceive and give birth to a son. No razor may be used on his head, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth, and he will begin the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines." When the woman went to her husband and told him, "A man of God came to me. He looked like an angel of God, very awesome. I didn't ask him where he came from, and he didn't tell me his name. But he said to me, 'You will conceive and give birth to a son. Now drink no wine or other fermented drink, and do not eat anything unclean, because the boy will be a Nazarite of God from birth until the day of his death.' Then Manoah prayed to the Lord, 'O Lord, I beg you, let the man of God you sent to us come again to teach us how to bring the boy up who is being to be born.' And God heard Manoah, and the angel of God came again to the woman while she was out in the field. But her husband Manoah was not with her. The woman hurried to tell her husband, He's here, the man who appeared to me the other day. Now, in the Hebrew Bible, a Nazirite is one who took an oath, a vow described in Numbers 6, verses 1 to 21. And the vow required the person to abstain from wine, wine vinegar, grapes, raisins, intoxicating liquors, or vinegars made from substances from grapes, or anything with the slightest trace of grapes. So obviously Nazirites had it in for grapes. So number 6 says, and this is the vow, or the story of how you become a Nazirite. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if for a man or a woman wants to make a special vow, a vow of dedication to the Lord as a Nazirite, they must abstain from wine and other fermented drink, and must not drink vinegar made from wine or other fermented drink. They must not drink grape juice or eat grapes or raisins as long as they remain under their Nazirite vow. They must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. During the entire period of the Nazirite vow, no razor may be used on their head. They must be holy until the period of their dedication to the Lord is over. They must let their hair grow long. Throughout the period of their dedication to the Lord, the Nazirite must not go near a dead body. Even if their own father or mother or brother or sister dies, they must not make themselves ceremonially unclean on account of them, because the symbol of their dedication to God is on their head. Throughout the period of their dedication, they are consecrated to the Lord." And when I read that, it kind of reminded me of the arrival of John the Baptist. He came proclaimed in a very similar way. I wonder if it shadows it. Now, the Bible tells us that as a result of God's people's disobedience, he delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. And I found it interesting reading the text. I found it interesting to note we're told twice in the text that Samson was judge over Israel for 20 years, possibly alluding to that 40 years. It's also worth reminding ourselves before we get too far into the story that God can and does use unholy people to bring his legitimate judgment on wrongdoers. Because Samson, at first inspection, looks like a really unlikely candidate to be a good example of great faith. Although we'll see in chapter 16 and verse 17, Samson is well aware of his special calling, but he does not appear to appreciate it or to live up to that calling. As we'll see, in terms of a flawed hero, Samson is head and shoulders above the rest. Probably because of the secular treatment of the Samson and Delilah story, it's not unusual for people not to realise that within Samson there are two key women in his life, or certainly that we're told about in the story. There's his wife, and then there's Delilah, who it would appear is not his wife. And in fact, there are at least four doubles or pairings in this story of Samson. There are two angelic visits, two proclamations of his coming, two women that nag, and two main stories of betrayal and revenge. And there may be more, but let's have a look at Samson's flaws. So chapter 14, 1 to 4. "Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his father and mother, 'I've seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife.' His father and mother replied, 'Isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or among all our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife?' But Samson said to his father, 'Get her for me. She's the right one for me.' His parents did not know that this was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines. For at the time, they were ruling over Israel." Now, God had forbidden his people from marrying from the peoples inhabiting the land that he had given to them in the through the Exodus. In fact, it commanded Israel to drive them out totally so they wouldn't influence God's people to share in their abhorrent practices. Now, God's people had failed to do that. Deuteronomy 7 tells us, when the Lord your God brings you into the land you're entering, this is when they were entering after the Exodus with Joshua, and drives out before you many nations, Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites. These are seven nations larger and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you've defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons, for they'll turn your children away from following me to serve other gods, and the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. Now, I know the Philistines aren't in that list, but certainly they're included in the peoples who lived in the land. When Samson's father then sought to dissuade him, you know, fathers amongst us, if we have a daughter and she happens to take on board a bit of a reprobate as a boyfriend, we might understand how Samson's father felt at that point, that perhaps this wasn't a good idea. Well, when he tried to dissuade him, Samson took no notice and, in fact, compelled his father to go and do the wrong thing. Go and get her for me. I bet Samson was a bit of an intimidating son to have around. Because Exodus 20, verse 12, and Deuteronomy 5, 16 tells us to honour our father and our mother. Now, I know it's not always easy because fathers and mothers are flawed like everybody else, and some are more flawed than others. But it's a promise. It's the first command in the Bible with a promise. It says, if you honour your father and your mother, it will go well with you in the land. But he didn't. He compelled his father to do something that his father knew was wrong. Let's carry on at verse 5. Verse 5 of 14. If I can find it again, I've lost it. Samson went down to Timnah together with his father and his mother. And as he approached the vineyards of Timnah, suddenly a young lion came roaring towards him. There must have been a little distance apart there. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power, so that he tore the lion apart with his bare hands, as he might have torn a young goat. But he told neither his father or his mother what he had done. That's why I'm suggesting they were a little distance apart. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and he liked her. Now, the NIV tends to hide our blushes, spare our blushes, because it tends to phrase things in a softer way than the original text would have done. So he more than liked her. He more than liked her. Now, let's carry on. So sometime later, when he went back to marry her, this is verse 8, he turned aside to look at the lion's carcass, and in it was a swarm of bees and some honey, which he scooped out with his hands, and he ate as he went along. And when he rejoined his parents, he gave them some, and they too ate it, but he did not tell them that he'd taken the honey from out of the lion's carcass. Now, Leviticus 7, verse 24 and 17, chapter 17 to 15, tells us that eating anything that you found dead already, it was already dead when you found it, it was unclean. Anybody who touched it or ate of it, they also became unclean. They weren't to eat of dead creatures. That just wasn't permitted. So by eating it himself, he became unclean. Remember, he's a Nazirite. He's dedicated to God. And then he gives it to his unsuspecting parents to eat. And they become unclean. So once again, he's dishonouring his parents. He's not showing his parents the honour he should duly give them. Verse 10. Now his father went down to see the woman, and Samson made a feast there, as was customary for bridegrooms. When he appeared, he was given 30 companions. Let me tell you a riddle, Samson said to them. If you can give me the answer within the 7 days of the feast, I'll give you 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. If you can't tell me the answer, then you must give me 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. Tell us your riddle, they said. Let's hear it. And he replied, out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet. For 3 days, they couldn't give the answer. So Samson was a gambler. Now, the Bible doesn't really have anything to say one way or the other about gambling. It acknowledges that it existed, because in the New Testament, the Roman soldiers cast lots. They had a lottery for who would win Jesus' underpants. Because when they crucified somebody, any belongings they had, the Roman centurions would share them out amongst themselves or split them up. But Jesus, the one thing he had that was nice was his undergarment was a seamless one piece, so very desirable. And they decided, we're not going to tear this cloth, let's cast lots, let's gamble for it. However, at the very least, gambling falls outside of God's normal legitimate provision for us. God's normal legitimate provision for us is trading, good honest trade, working for pay, receiving it as a gift or as an inheritance. And so in gambling, although there's nothing in the law about it, but it can easily be a way to try and get provision outside of trusting in God. It's one of the reasons why I don't do the lottery. I have entered the lottery occasionally, generally when I've been watching the TV show, The Lottery Changed My Life, and I see all the nice things that you can get with a lottery win. But this is looking for provision outside of what God might want for me. God doesn't provide to us through luck, if you believe in luck, which I don't. I don't believe in luck. I believe in a sovereign God. Okay, so verses 15 to 18, let's keep going. On the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, coax your husband into explaining the riddle for us, or we'll burn you and your father's household to death. I've had that threat. Did you invite us here to rob us? Let's see where we get to. 18. Then Samson's wife threw herself on him, sobbing, you hate me! You don't really love me! You give my people a riddle! You haven't told me the answer! I haven't even explained it to my father and my mother, he replied, so why should I explain it to you? She cried the whole 7 days of the feast. So on the seventh day, he finally told her, because she continued to press him, and she in turn explained the riddle to her people. And before the seventh day, the men of the town said to him, what's sweeter than honey, and what's stronger than a lion? And Samson said to them, if you'd not ploughed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. Now, I've got some sympathy for Samson's Philistine wife, because I've had the threat of being burned to death. And it's scary. But Samson was no wimp, was he? She could have told Samson that she was being threatened. He was a mighty warrior. Instead, she gave in and began to nag him. Nag, nag, nag. Now, Proverbs 21, verse 19 says, it's better to live in the desert than with a quarrelsome and nagging wife. So eventually, Samson gives in and tells her the answer to his riddle. And she, in turn, betrays his confidence. Proverbs lets the men off lightly. There's nothing in there about a nagging husband. They do exist, ask my wife. However, men, we don't get away so lightly in the New Testament, where married men are commanded to love their wives as Christ has loved his church. That's quite a calling, brothers. And all men to respect the females as if they were our sister. So Samson, in his anger, describes his wife as a heifer. He's calling her a cow, isn't he? And I did, when I read that, I thought, I wonder if that's where the insult comes from, because, you know, occasionally a bad man will call his wife a cow, and I have called my wife a silly cow once or twice, haven't I, dear? Do forgive me. Is this where it comes from? Perhaps somebody more knowledgeable. I don't see Trevor here today. He's a lot more knowledgeable than me. I'll put it on the internet and find out. Is that the origins of calling women cows? Which is obviously an inappropriate way to describe any woman, and I repent of it. So, on we go. What happens after he's called his wife a cow? Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power. He went down to Ashkelon, and he struck down 30 of their men. He stripped them of their belongings and gave their clothes to those who had explained the riddle. And burning with anger, he went up to his father's house. And Samson's wife was given to a friend who had attended him at the wedding. So Samson's a killer and a thief. He kills 30 men from Ashkelon, probably at random. And he takes their clothes and gives them to these other guys. So he's a killer and he's a thief. And Exodus 20 verse 13 commands us, you shall not murder. Now, sometimes when I've encountered people who are not Christians, who are not versed in the Bible, and sometimes even people who are, they often translate as, thou shalt not kill. You might have heard that. They say, oh yeah, you know, the Bible says, thou shalt not kill, so what's all this killing going on? It says, thou, you shall not murder. It's a different thing. It's quite a different thing from being a soldier or being an agent of the state. They're different. And the text tells us that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him and gave him power to enable him to carry out that act. Just like it says that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him when he fought the lion. That's hard to understand. Spirit of the Lord coming upon him so he can kill these people, take their clothes, or tear up this lion. Poor little lion. We shouldn't overlook, though, that as one of the judges, he's a judge. There's an element of divine judgment at work in Samson's actions. Divine judgment against a wicked people. God works sometimes through unholy people in ways that we find hard. But he's the right to. He is the judge. God is the judge. So in verse 20, Samson has stormed off angrily to his father's house. Angry. He's an angry man. And presumably his Philistine wife, she went back to her father's house, where she got married off to one of the wedding guests from before. What a to-do. Chapter 15 then, 1 to 5. Later on, at the time of the wheat harvest, Samson took a young goat and went to visit his wife. He said, I'm going to my wife's room. But her father would not let him go in. I was so sure that you thoroughly hated her, he said, that I gave her to your friend. Isn't her younger sister more attractive? Take her instead. Ooh. Samson said to them, this time I've a right to get even with the Philistines. I'll really harm them. So he went out and caught 300 foxes and tied them tail to tail in pairs. And he then fastened a torch to every pair of tails. You know, that's a flaming torch. Lit the torches and let the foxes loose in the standing corn of the Philistines. He burned up the shocks and the standing corn with the vineyards and the olive groves. Now, I don't know if this offer of the younger sister was culturally normal at this sort of time, or whether the father-in-law was just simply terrified of this big, angry Samson. But I've got to feel sorry for the girl. She's just being treated like so much property. Oh, I thought you hated her, so I gave her to so-and-so. What a horrible way to be treated. Well, whichever of those you choose, Samson had neglected to leave and to cleave. Genesis 2, 23 and 24 says, within the creation account, when Eve was formed, the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She should be called woman, for she was taken out of man. Verse 24, that is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Now, Samson hadn't. He had gone home in a rage to his father's house, and his wife had returned to her father's house. And then Samson thought, I'll go down one day with a goat, hop into bed with my wife, I know where she is, and he finds that she's been married off to another. So he gets in a very bad mood and angry and decides he's going to go and burn all the corn of the Philistines by setting fire to foxes. Now, as someone who's instructed gamekeepers, I can assure you that catching even one fox is not all that easy, let alone 300. Where did he put them? How long did it take? You know, I went to Fox Village in a foreign country where there's a special zoo dedicated to foxes, because in this country they revere foxes almost as gods. And there was 200 or so foxes in this enclosure, and you could go in and feed the foxes. That's a lot of foxes. And you've got to feed them, look after them. I don't know how he did it or how he put up with the stink, because foxes are incredibly smelly. Just think of the worst urinal you've ever been near. A fox is smellier than that. Now, setting aside the animal cruelty aspect, because tying foxes' tails together and setting them on fire, I think is really cruel. But it's a different time and a different place and a different culture. But what he did was especially vengeful, because it would deprive the people of their harvest and usher in famine. So all this resulted in further bloodshed. And you can read about all that bloodshed in the remainder of chapter 15. We're not going to go there. All I can say is that his former wife and her family are burnt to death by the angry Philistines. Samson's own people turn on him and want to hand him over to the Philistines to avoid trouble. And again, he's empowered by the Spirit of the Lord. And this time, he kills 1,000 Philistines. It keeps going up, doesn't it? It keeps going up. Do you see how tit for tat vengeance just keeps on escalating? It just keeps escalating. When you pay somebody back wrong for wrong, it escalates. It just keeps escalating. But don't feel too sorry for these Philistines, because the practices of the Philistines were abominable. Absolutely abominable. I won't even describe them. But it drew God's judgment on them. And they were worthy of judgment. And so we come to Delilah. I'm not going to do my Tom Jones impression. But chapter 16, this is the one that the general public are most interested in. So let's read 1 to 4. One day, Samson went to Gaza, where he saw a prostitute. And he went in to spend the night with her. The people of Gaza were told, Samson's here. So they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the city gate. They made no move during the night, saying, at dawn we'll kill him. But Samson lay there only until the middle of the night. Then he got up, took hold of the doors of the city gate together with the two posts, tore them loose, bar and all, lifted them on top of his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. So we see that Samson wasn't coy about going with prostitutes. He wasn't a moral man. He was an immoral man. And he didn't mind leaving his calling card, because there weren't many people who could tear up the city gates by their posts, bar and all, and carry them to the top of the hill and leave them facing Hebron. Now, there's probably some special meaning in that, but without going to the commentaries, I'm not aware of it beyond Samson was pretty much proving a point. I'm Samson, don't take me on, I'm mega tough. Come and have a go if you think you're hard enough. That's Samson. 5 to 21, big bit of checks, so just listen. The rulers of the Philistines went to Delilah, who he'd fallen in love with. They went to her and said, see if you can lure him, Samson, into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so that we may tie him up and subdue him. Each one of us is going to give you 1,100 shekels of silver. So Delilah said to Samson, tell me the secret of your great strength and how you can be tied up and subdued. Samson answered her, "If anyone ties me with 7 fresh thongs that have not been dried, I'll become as weak as any other man." Then the rulers of the Philistines brought her 7 fresh thongs that had not been dried, and she tied him with them. With men hidden in the room, she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." But he snapped the thongs as easily as a piece of string snaps when it comes close to a flame. So the secret of his strength was not discovered. Then Delilah said to Samson, "You've made a fool of me. You lied to me. Come now, tell me how you can be tied." He said, "If anyone ties me securely with new rope that's never been used, I'll become as weak as any other man." So Delilah took new ropes and tied him with them. Then the men hidden in the room called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." But he snapped the ropes off his arms as if they were just threads. And Delilah said to Samson, "Until now you've been making a fool of me, lying to me. Tell me how you can be tied." He replied, "If you weave the 7 braids of my hair into fabric on the loom and tighten it with a pin, I'll become as weak as any other man." So while he was sleeping, Delilah took the 7 braids of his head, wove them into fabric, and tied it with a pin. Again she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." He woke up from his sleep, pulled up the pin and the loom with the fabric. Then she said to him, "How can you say, 'I love you,' when you won't confide in me?" It's a bit thick, isn't it? You think you might have spotted a theme developing by this point? "This is the 3rd time you've made a fool of me and haven't told me the secret of your great strength." With such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was tired to death. So he told her everything. "No razor has ever been used on my head," he said, "because I have been a Nazarite, set apart to God since birth. If my head were ever shaved, my strength would leave me, and I've become as weak as any other man." When Delilah saw that he had told her everything, she went, sent word to the rulers of the Philistines, "Come back once more, he's told me everything." So the rulers of the Philistines returned with the silver in their hands. I know somebody else who was betrayed with silver in their hands. Having put him to sleep on her lap, she called a man to shave off the 7 braids of his hair, and so began to subdue him, and his strength left him. And she called, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." And he woke from his sleep and thought, "I'll go out just like before and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had left him. Then the Philistines seized him, gouged out his eyes, took him down to Gaza, put him in prison. You know, Samson knew full well his special calling, verse 17, but he's overconfident in himself and his strength and his abilities. In the New Testament, James interprets Proverbs 3:34 as, "God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble." Samson was proud. He dishonored his parents. He ate unclean foods. He married a foreigner. He didn't leave and cleave to her. He gambled. He killed thousands of people. He stole. He was a man of anger. He behaved immorally. He became proud and he trusted in his own strength. And finally, having treated his calling so lightly, the Lord left him. That also happened to King Saul when he consulted with the witch of Endor. The Lord left him. When I read, in the case of King Saul, that the Lord left him, you know, that scared me. That scared me so much until I realized that's that side of the cross. And we live on that side of the cross. Thank God we live on that side of the cross. Because in Hebrews 13, verse 5, I found out that that could never happen to me, and it can't happen to you if you're a follower of Jesus, you've given your heart to him. Because God says, "Never will I leave you, and never will I forsake you." And believe me, it's not possible for God to lie. God promises, "I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you." So this is something that could happen under the old covenant, but it's not something that can happen to us under the new and better covenant. And the Philistines put out his eyes. So, having spent so long doing it his way, metaphorically went from light to darkness, from sight to blindness. How's this man a great example of faith? Well, the story doesn't end there. And we're on the home run on verse 21. Well, actually, we'll go to 23. Now the rulers of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to, I'm not sure if it's Dagon or Dagon, but it's not worth saying anyway, their God, and to celebrate, saying, "Our God has delivered Samson, our enemy, into our hands." And when the people saw him, they praised their God, saying, "Our God has delivered our enemy into our hands, the one who wasted our land and multiplied our slain." And while they were in high spirits, they shouted, "Bring out Samson to entertain us." So they called Samson out of the prison, and he performed for them, presumably sort of feats of strength or something. When they stood him among the pillars, that's when they'd finished, Samson said to the servant who was holding him by the hand, "Put me where I may lean against the pillars." Now the temple was crowded with men and women. All the rulers of the Philistines were there. And on the roof there were about 3,000 men and women watching Samson performing. Then Samson prayed to the Lord, "O sovereign God, remember me. O God, please strengthen me just one more time. And let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes." And Samson reached towards the two central pillars on which the temple stood. Bracing himself against them, his right hand on one, his left hand on the other, Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." Then he pushed with all his might, and down came the temple on the rulers and all the people in it. And thus he killed many more people when he died than while he lived. What's the message for us? What's the message of Samson? He's an example to us, so what's the message? No matter how badly you think you fouled up, you can still turn back to God. And God can still use you. I don't think anybody in this room is likely to foul up as badly as Samson did. The final act of Samson's life, his final act of faith, was to turn back to God. He could have been bitter, he could have been angry, he could have resented God, he could have felt sorry for himself. He turned to God and said, "Oh God, will you strengthen me just one more time? Just one more time." He found purpose at the end of his life. You see, in the temple of this evil god, Dagon or Dagon or whatever it is, and you can read more about that god in 1 Samuel 5, because he was the god of the Philistines, and the worship of that god was too awful for me to describe here. In fact, sometimes I think I wish I didn't know. There are times I wish I could unknow things, because they're hard to live with. And maybe some can understand that too, the things that they have to live with. So, he called out to God. Samson stretched out his arms, and he brought judgment on over 3,000 people. 2,000 years ago, Jesus Christ stretched out his hands and he brought the offer of forgiveness for all who would turn from their own ways to follow him. What have we learned from Samson? If you've committed to follow Jesus, you have a calling. We heard that today, didn't we? We've heard that. You have a calling. We all have a calling. Tent pegs, we have a calling to hold fast. We've all got a calling. And God will use you to achieve his purposes even when we're not worthy. Because we're not worthy. It's the grace of God. Unmerited, undeserved, unearnable favor. God is just for you because he's just for you. We're not worthy. I'm not worthy. You're not worthy. None of us are worthy. But our God is for us. And he's made us right with him through the shed blood of his son, Jesus Christ. But if we persist in sinning, there'll be consequences sooner or later. You see, one of the charges against the evangelical church, us happy clappies, We don't do a lot of clapping lately, and I hope we're quite happy. But the charge is that we're antinomian, which is just a fancy name for we sort of say, let's sin and enjoy it. All sin's okay now. We can just go out and sin. Doesn't matter. Christ has paid for everything, so we just go out and sin. That's not the message. Yeah, we're not going to get right with God through our obedience to the law, but through Jesus Christ crucified. But it doesn't change the fact that if you sin, there will be consequences. If you go out and murder somebody, the police will get you and lock you up and your family will suffer. These things will happen. We're not exempt from them. Equally well, if we persist in certain acts, there'll be areas where God is less able to use us. So if you're a thief, probably not a good idea to be in charge of the money and to face that. What else do we learn? Keeping bad company corrupts good character. I'm sure Samson was raised well as a Nazarite child. Bad company corrupts good character. That's a very difficult one for us Christians because we're meant to be in the world, mixing with the world. Yeah, not withdrawing into a holy huddle, but mixing with the world. And that will bring us into difficult encounters with people with very different values and very different lifestyles. How do we do that? Well, that's one for a whole other message. But I would just say this one thing. If you're going to mix with people who are of bad character, make sure you cleave very tightly to your church and make yourself accountable to a few trusted brothers and sisters in Christ who will watch what you're doing. Because I've seen too many people go off with the idea of a ministry to this, that, or the other, and they drift away and they fall away from their first love and they forget that first and foremost, we're here to share the gospel, to worship God and share the gospel and love one another, not to go off on some sort of vegan ministry or something. It does not matter what you've done, brothers and sisters. It does not matter how far you've strayed. It's never too late to turn back to God. While you're still breathing, God still's got a purpose for you to fulfill. Yeah, while you're still breathing. I think we're all breathing in the room. We're all breathing. So God has still got purposes for each and every one of us to fulfill. And your purpose will be different from my purpose, will be different from Haley's purpose, but we'll all have a purpose. Nobody here is purposelessness. And we had that earlier as well. You know, we don't collude on these things. We don't sort of like get together and arrange it in advance. We're all flawed. Some are more flawed than others. But turn your heart to God. And like the prodigal son, you will find God with his arms open wide, waiting for you. Actually, he'll come to you. He'll run to you, like the prodigal son. He didn't wait for the son. He ran to him. Brothers, sisters, if you've lost heart, if you have had a calling once, but nothing happened very much, and you thought, well, maybe it was just good intentions, and you gave up. It's the right time. There's a time and a season and a place. Don't give up on your calling. Don't feel useless. Don't feel surplus to requirements. Don't drift away to some other, even a good cause. Stay close to where God has put you. Stay close to your brothers and sisters. Love one another. Encourage one another. Build one another up. This is a great calling. Share the gospel. Share what God has done for you. If you've got a unique and special calling, don't give up on it, because sometimes there's a long period of time of preparation. So today, if you've given up, come back. If you've lost heart, take heart. If you've decided I'm just surplus to requirements, get pegged in hard to the ground and be strongly attached, because God put you here. Nothing happens by accident. There is no chance. I don't believe in chance. God is a sovereign God. You're here today because God wanted you here. And you're meaningful and important. And the church will be so much weaker without you. And God will use you if you put your heart to him. Seek God. Look to God. Got one more song to worship as our young people come back. But if today, you know, perhaps something's touched you, you think, yeah, I want to come back to God, or I've given up on a hope or a dream I had long ago that I thought was God's calling for me, we'll have people over here who will pray with you, and you can find God's arms open wide even today. Brothers and sisters, let's worship God and have a wonderful week, fulfilling his purposes for us.